Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 71, Cambaceres, Second Council of France. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you'd like to support our podcast, please go to patreon.com/generalsandnapoleon. There, you'll find a $5 a month option and a $10 a month option for supporting our program. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please go to YouTube, Spotify, or Instagram and give us a follow and a like. Now, on with the show. We have our good friend Charles McKay joining us. Say hello, Charles.
Hey, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'm happy to have you again. Charles is a frequent contributor to the show. For those who are uninitiated, Charles, can you get everyone a bit of background on your studies of the Napoleonic era?
Sure. I did my PhD at Florida State at the Institute of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Studies. Mm-hmm. And I worked for years as an academic teaching at both Morehead State University and WVU.
Oh, yeah. West Virginia University. That's right.
Indeed.
Fantastic. Well, who are we going to discuss today? I think he's kind of an interesting character.
We are going to discuss today Cambaceres, the second consul and the gentleman largely responsible for drafting the Code Napoleon, what became known as the Code Napoleon.
Okay, so everyone that listens to this podcast probably knows that Napoleon became first consul of France in 1799, but many forget that he was one of three consuls who were supposed to rule the government, I guess kind of like a Roman triumvirate, or right, like some sort of power-sharing ruler.
Exactly.
Yeah, and these other two guys, one was Cambaceres, and the other one was a guy named Lebrun. Who are these guys? Were they just flunkies, or were they very smart individuals?
They are definitely not flunkies. But they were chosen for their, you know, backing up just a little bit to lead into the coup of Brumaire. This was engineered, at least the thinking part was engineered by the Abbé Sieyès, who long time, you know, an important pre-revolutionary figure, survived all of the different governments during the revolution, and then wanted to set up the what became known as the consulate. And he had a whole scheme for doing this. He mm-hmm. and Cambaceres were well known to each other, and had worked together during the course of the revolution on various things. So Cambaceres gets pulled into this through his association with the Abbé Sieyès.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you for that background. Well, let's kind of back up even a bit more. Cambaceres was born in October 1753 in Montpellier, France. Do you know what his upbringing was like?
We don't know too much. He had a brother who went into the clergy, and his family was from a prominent, they had a prominent legal background, and they were nobles who essentially bought their nobility in the 17th century. Mm. So there's a long family history of their activity in law, and Cambaceres goes to the law school there in Montpellier, and by all traces looks like he's going to follow his father, who was also a functionary and then became the mayor of Montpellier. It should be noted that many of these posts they bought, but the Cambaceres were known for their competence. Mm. And you know, their ability to master the law and get things done.
All right, and thank you for pronouncing Montpellier properly for me. I'm used to the American version, you know, up in New England, right? There, Montpellier.
Yep.
Yeah. Like you said, he kind of follows in his dad's footsteps. 1774, he graduates from law school, basically. Mm-hmm. Do you know what his first career choice was?
Yeah, he started as a functionary. He followed his father, actually, as a, he might have been a notary in Montpellier, and just literally when his father amasses enough wealth to buy the next position in line, it's just, you know, Jean-Jacques, his son, just kind of slots up into the next rung.
Okay, so things are going good. He's gonna follow his father's footsteps and become a lawyer, but he gets kind of swept up in the French Revolution of 1789. and he holds a seat in the National Convention. He has an interesting role in the trial of the deposed King Louis XVI. It's interesting in that he's very, like you said, he's very rational and makes careful decisions. They could come back to haunt him later, but they don't, because he's somewhat rational in his decisions when dealing with the deposed king, don't you think?
Yeah, and so he gets elected kind of in 1789. He gets elected from the nobility as a sort of backup representative. There was some idea that perhaps one of the actions Louis XVI would take to kind of keep an eye on the Third Estate or not let the, you know, Estates General get out of control was to have essentially they might double the number of noble representatives. And Cambaceres was a backup for that. He's well liked by just about everybody. He doesn't really have any enemies.
Right.
And part of that is his skill. But also, I think part of that is he was very active in Freemasonry. And he had a pretty wide net of contacts through that. And between the years of 1789 and 1792, when the trial of the king happens, he gets elected not only to positions within, you know, the French government and, you know, committee chairs and things like that, but also he's moving up within the ranks of Freemasonry as well.
Okay.
So, and he is a kind of a far thinker. Yeah, you know, if you hear sometimes people make analogies to chess, he's often, you know, 3, 4, 5 moves ahead of his contemporaries in planning his next steps. And he knew that putting the king on trial,
right,
was going to be fraught with. Well, it was going to be fraud. It was going to be dangerous for him not to vote for the king's death. But at the end of the day, Cambaceres is a pretty moderate in his views. And I don't think personally, and this is just a personal opinion, I don't have any evidence to back this up that I could put my hands on at the moment. I don't think he wanted the king to be executed.
Right. Right.
So what he does is he does vote for the guilt of the king in terms of, you know, crimes against France, if you will. I don't think there was much doubt that or much political damage in voting that way.
Right.
I think that it comes down to what they're going to do with the king's execution.
Right. Because I think he wanted to hold off on the execution, at least for several months. Let's kind of just see how things shake out and just imprison him.
Sure. And the crux of his argument was not an emotional one. It was one of trying to figure out whether France's newly consummated legislature had the authority to try the king.
Right.
And that's where he based his objections, wondering if the legislature had jurisdiction, if you want to, over the life and times of the king in that case.
Okay.
So he made his argument predicated on that. And then he was able to, at least in his own mind, argue, and he did argue that, you know, maybe we should table the consequences portion of this verdict until we've worked out what role we think the legislature has in overseeing the monarch.
Okay. Well, it was said that his legal expertise made him useful to all factions of France. And like you said, he had many powerful friends. Do you think he had an eye on the prize of ruling France? Because, you know, Robespierre ruled for a little bit and there was kind of like a lot of interesting characters that kind of had control of France. Do you think he ever wanted that? Like he wanted to be number one?
I don't. Mm-hmm. And there's no, we don't have any evidence that, you know, he didn't express that in any correspondence, and none of the contemporaries revealed him to be particularly ambitious. You know, juxtapose him with, say, Fouché, and everybody knew that, you know, Fouché wanted to, you know, be the top dog at some point in life, right, for Talleyrand. But there's not that same sort of buzz surrounding Cambaceres. And I would like to clarify, or just back up for a half second. He did ultimately vote for the king's execution. After there was an initial round of ballots, and in that initial round of ballots, they had a number of different options, including, you know, commutation and basically life in prison, and then execution. The votes came down, and by a single vote, the legislature voted to execute Louis.
Right.
And they thought that vote was a little too close. They wanted to be more careful, and they had a subsequent vote several days later, which carried more of a, more folks voted for the king's death.
More so, of a majority vote on that one.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So he was, and he did the calculation and eventually became a regicide.
Well, yeah. And like I said earlier, there's going to be repercussions for that regicide later on, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in 1795, just moving the story along, he serves on the Council of 500, as you said, is considered a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
He also serves as a diplomat. He had admissions to Spain, Prussia, and Tuscany. He had really good debate skills. Just sound like a really valuable guy for France at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And he also, at this point, by that point, by 1795, had already submitted two drafts to overhaul France's entire legal system.
I always describe people just archaic. It was very, I guess, it depended on what territory of France you're in, with the laws you had to follow, correct? It was very, I guess, decentralized.
Well, that's a great way to say it, because of course, France was put together over the course of time through an amalgamation of marriages and wars and conflict and oftentimes negotiation, and then sometimes the regions would negotiate their own particular, you know, regional customs and values and things. So, you know, on the eve of the revolution, there wasn't a legal system in France. There were hundreds of different legal systems, some of them in the southern part of France based on Roman law, some of them in the northern part of France based on Norman law. You had a whole bunch of different feudal rights all over the place. Right. I mean, it was a total mess in France. Trying to figure out how to bring any kind of case to court, just knowing where the legal jurisdictions were, you know, was a real challenge.
Okay, well, we'll put a pin on that till 1804. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
In 1799, he's serving as Minister of Justice, using his legal skills, and supports Napoleon's coup for power in November of that year. Why do you think Napoleon appreciated his skills so much?
Well, I think he appreciated that you might have noticed there's a little bit of gap there between 1795 and 1799.
Yep.
Cambaceres is viewed as a little too politically conservative for the directors. Mm-hmm. So he essentially recedes into the background, working on some low-level stuff, and then mostly spending time, you know, honing and polishing his Mason connections and things.
Got it.
And so I think Napoleon appreciated that kind of conservatism, but the Cambaceres also did have a good friendship with CA, and it's CA is the one that drives the coup in 1799. So the night before the coup, they actually all get together in Cambaceres' house to, you know, get their marching orders, so to speak. So I think Cambaceres had an opportunity to impress Napoleon with his competence and with his, you know, command of the situation and probably his ability to see two or three steps ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And following Napoleon's appointment to first consul, Cambaceres becomes second consul of France, and Lebrun becomes third consul. Lebrun kind of focuses on more of the accounting and treasury stuff, right? While Cambaceres is doing the legal stuff.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. There's a great quote there, if you don't mind sharing with me, about going to dinner with the three consuls.
Yeah. So one of the things that Cambaceres was known for and would certainly get more known for were his lavish dinner parties. He and Talleyrand would often sort of compete, and they both used a very famous chef of the age, Antoine Carême, who working on pastries. Carême was a pastry guy, but he also changed because he was working with Talleyrand. at the time of when the Allies occupied Paris in 1814, mm-hmm. Talleyrand was entertaining the Tsar, Tsar Alexander I, and the Tsar was so impressed with Kerem that he convinced Talleyrand to let him have Kerem for the time period where he was occupying Paris. Mm. And one of the things that Alexander I insisted on was, in the Russian style, they serve their courses in turn. So for an American audience, you would have your appetizer and then your salad and then your entree and then your dessert and whatever in succession. Mm-hmm. The French style had been to put all of the courses on the table at once.
Ah, I see.
But it was this battle between Cambaceres and Talleyrand of mm-hmm. who could hold the better dinner party that really kind of intensified that rivalry between those two and brought Kerem eventually to worldwide prominence. But Napoleon really liked Cambaceres, and you can sort of tell if Napoleon gives you a little bit of a hard time, he teases because he loves.
Right.
And he had a quote that this is what Napoleon said: "If you want to dine well, dine with Cambaceres. If you want to dine badly, dine with Lebrun. If you want to dine quickly, dine with me."
That sounds very accurate. Yeah.
So Napoleon was of course notorious for the rapidity at which he consumed his meals. Mm. I mean, no better example of that is at the marriage in 1810 to Marie Louise. They have a massive banquet for 3,000 people, which Kerem was part of, and Cambaceres was largely in charge of putting together. And, you know, the emperor finishes this whole massive undertaking in about 20 minutes. The guests are just shocked because Correct. They're not used to this. They're used to at least a 3-hour production, if not a 5-hour production. Cambaceres was notorious for sometimes holding 5-hour dinner parties.
Oh, my.
And of course, the day and the time was you just can't keep eating. If the emperor is done and stands up, then everybody's done.
Yeah, everyone's done. That's right. Well, going back to our story, Napoleon kind of pushes Cambaceres and Lebrun to the sidelines in terms of power. Do you think the other two councils minded this? Like, I think they didn't like despotism that Napoleon had within him, but they seem to be okay with still being, you know, in power in France, correct?
Yes, I think that's exactly accurate. I think both of them, to a certain extent, both of them were chosen because of their personalities, in the case that I don't want to say they're subservient, mm-hmm. Because that I think that implies some obsequiousness that isn't there. Mm-hmm. But neither one of them particularly sought the spotlight like that.
Right.
And I think they were fine. And Napoleon really empowers, well, Cambaceres in particular, with a great deal of power behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And that suits him fine.
Yeah. And, you know, as a ruler, like Abraham Lincoln, you know, you want to hire people that are smarter than you to do the things you don't want to do, which is overhaul the legal system, overhaul the financial system. And that's kind of what those two guys did.
Correct. And, you know, their success at those were critical. Mm-hmm. And Bonaparte's popularity.
Indeed. So here we go back to the discussion I put a pin on. In 1804, Napoleon unveils his most famous legacy, which is the Napoleonic Code. But Cambaceres was the real brainchild behind this important work, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. He'd been working on this by this time, by 1804, he's working on this for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. So he's made draft after draft after draft. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, two final reports during the revolution, but the timing just wasn't right on either one of those times for France to take up something like that. And Cambaceres is at the perfect place at the perfect time to roll out the code. Now, the code was done, a good 16, 18 months before 1804. And Cambaceres was part of a committee. There were four other jurists who participated, but it was really Cambaceres who was in the driver's seat for this. And I should say that Bonaparte attended about half of the sessions personally and did have a big influence on what the civil code, you know, would eventually look like. Because I think Bonaparte was smart enough to realize that the quickest way to really permanently cement a lot of the gains that had happened during the French Revolution was through a clear and concise, a clearly articulated law system.
Let's discuss the code, and I'm going to say briefly because, you know, I try to keep it under an hour for these shows.
well, right. How many times have I said, well, you could do a whole cast on that?
You could. Yeah. I mean, and to look at it from afar, it's somewhat nebulous, but once you get into it, it's very clear to a lot of countries. Why was this code so important to France and to world history, and the fact that we still use it today? Like, what was it really?
Well, really what it did was it codified a lot of the principles that came out of the French Revolution. And, you know, for American audiences, you know, they might shrug and say, well, I mean, I don't know, what are you talking about? This is the way it's always been. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, starting at the most basic thing, like equality before the law, that all of the citizens of France would be looked at equally
right.
under the eyes of the law. And of course, that wasn't the case before the revolution. You had specific social classes. Nobility had different rules and rights and obligations they followed. Clergy was largely not present in the judicial system. They had their own, you know, process for resolving whatever crimes they might have.
Right.
And, you know, the access to justice was not, it wasn't equal. And through the revolution and codified through the code is the base, the most basic of that, that all people are equal in the eyes of the law. And yeah. that opened up things like careers being open to men with talent. And probably one of the most important things the code did was to kind of regulate the relationship between people and the state and property.
Mm.
And you'll recall that much of the support for Napoleon at home are from these new, what he called the masses of granite, from these new middle-class folks who now own property that previously they weren't able to own.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was former church land, but a lot of it was land seized from emigres and things. And so obviously, if Napoleon is going to codify something that's going to allow them to keep those assets, then that's going to bring Napoleon a lot of loyalty from those folks.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the property stuff in particular, and it's sane stuff. So the code is based off of Roman law. Mm-hmm. So this is clear and basic principles. It was published in vernacular French, so everybody could read it. It wasn't a mystery. And again, all of this talking about this in the 21st century, you know, as to Americans, and I know we have a worldwide audience, but you know, these are things that we just grow up with as kids knowing that's just the way things work.
Yeah, you take it for granted that, oh, it was always like this, but it wasn't. And I think some critics would say, oh, it was forced upon other countries by Napoleon's conquests. And my counter is like, well, they clearly like the Napoleonic Code because they're still using it to this day. They didn't right. come up with something better afterwards, you know?
Right. And both of those can be true at the same time, right? So, right. yes, it's entirely possible that, well, it was in fact the case that the code was forced onto some folks throughout Europe. Mm-hmm. But then they don't change it when Napoleon gets toppled in 1814. And, you get the reactions after that. And none of these places throw the code out because it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, still used worldwide, which is
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, so moving along in our story, in 1805, Cambaceres is starting to disapprove of Napoleon's accumulation of power. You know, he's an emperor now, but he essentially becomes the second most powerful politician in France, correct? Because Napoleon's usually out on campaign.
Yep, that is correct. So when he finally ends the consulate, you know, Cambaceres gets a new title, but he's de facto Napoleon's second. When Napoleon is away from Paris, either through examining, you know, the camp at Boulogne or actually on campaign, mm-hmm. it's Cambaceres who's running the day-to-day things in Paris. And it's true, Cambaceres did, he disapproved of the consul for life. He disapproved of the conversion of the consulate into an empire. Mm-hmm. He disapproved of Napoleon reestablishing nobility. Cambaceres was, again, we've talked about his moderation, but he was a revolutionary at heart. And while he disapproved of these things, he also realized that after the horrible abuses before the revolution, and then the tumult and chaos during the revolution, he regarded Napoleon as a pragmatist. And I think he looked at Napoleon as sort of the ultimate fulfillment of an 18th century concept of an enlightened despot. And while the path that Napoleon was taking might not be his first choice, he saw enough good in what Bonaparte was doing to continue to support and, in fact, enable that.
Right. And, you know, I know Napoleon and the people of France liked the stability that they had. But I think it's great that Napoleon had this guy in Paris that he could leave behind. Because I know there was always conspiracies to topple Napoleon, the Malay conspiracy, to name one. So yep. I think it was just helpful Napoleon to have this pragmatic man rule domestic policies while he was away on campaign.
Right. And it should be said that you know, Napoleon did not fear Cambaceres, didn't regard him as a rival or as someone who would seize power.
Right.
Even though Cambaceres may not have had, you know, may not have shared Napoleon's views on, you know, Consul for Life or the Empire. It should also be said that Cambaceres opposed Napoleon's operations in Spain and also opposed Napoleon's invasion of Russia.
Yep. And we will come back to that for sure. Yeah. Let's discuss Cambaceres' personal life. It was an extravagant one. You know, he had many debts that he ran up and he liked to spend lavishly, like you said. What else do we know about his personal life?
Well, he was a flamboyant a dude in every sense of the way. He was openly gay in a time period where that was really, really unusual. Mm. Although that doesn't seem to have really factored much into, you know, the thoughts that people had of him during the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he tended to hang out with a lot of bachelors, which you would expect under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. But it didn't get in the way of him doing his job. And, you know, Napoleon would tease him on occasion about his preference for hanging out with men rather than women. But it was a good-natured, if those things can be coined as good-natured, it was a good-natured razzing. And the fact that Cambaceres was openly gay, remarkably, is probably one of the least interesting facets of his, you know, personal life and of his life outside of his official duties.
Yeah.
It just doesn't come up really as a thing.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the code, you do get asked a lot about, you know, what did he do anything? What did he do to, you know, decriminalize homosexual activity in France? The revolution had done a lot of that, eliminated a lot of that, although not specifically. The revolution did end a lot of persecutions that the church would do.
Right. It was a serious crime in France before the revolution under the Bourbon.
Well, it was a capital crime, in fact. So, yeah. I mean, you could get executed, but
yeah, burned at the stake, which is crazy.
Yeah. So, but I mean, there were like five people in the 18th century that were charged with that. So this was not something that's
actively, you know,
that
prosecuted. Well,
right. Happens all that often. And so lumped up with eliminating laws against sodomy included, like, you know, witchcraft and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, he was also a renowned gourmand, as we've talked about. So he would hold lavish dinner parties, and he and Talleyrand in particular used to compete to you know, see who could outdo the other one in terms of these things. And Napoleon was fine, super happy, in fact, to push those duties onto Cambaceres.
Right.
Cambaceres was noted for his rather rotund appearance. He was Napoleon and others would kid him for his gluttony. So he did like to eat and have a big party.
Yeah.
So,
and I know Napoleon liked his marshals and his ministers put on, you know, parties and fetes and all that kind of thing. So
sure, absolutely. And Cambaceres was a little bit better at managing his finances than others.
Mm-hmm.
When he does, in fact, die, he's worth millions of francs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he has squirreled away, invested well.
So he could run off debts, but he could pay them off as well. So.
Yes, okay. Yes. And, you know, Napoleon, as you know, better than most, I would suspect, Berthier was the most highly compensated of the marshals.
Yep.
So Napoleon knew who the important people were, and Cambaceres was well compensated for his efforts.
Yeah, yeah. In 1808, he's made Duke of Parma by Napoleon, and it seems like the emperor really appreciated his skills and rewards him along the way.
He does. Curiously, Cambaceres opposed. He tried to decline that ennoblement. He did not want the title, and this was one that that particular one, the Duke of Parma, came with an income attached to it as well, mm-hmm. and it was hereditary. And Cambaceres, you know, tried to decline the offer, but eventually, of course, did take it.
Well, we know things go poorly kind of after that in Spain and Russia, and after the fall of Napoleon in 1814, Cambaceres retires to private life but returns as Minister of Justice during the Hundred Days. So it seems like Napoleon could always rely on him, but after Napoleon's second abdication in 1815, Cambaceres is exiled, and could you tell us why in 1815?
Yeah, and this is interesting, and this is kind of one of those moments where his, you know, playing chess three and four moves ahead, you know, there's only so much you can do. So, yes, he did rally to Napoleon, and he was named the Minister of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't actually assume the post,
mm-hmm.
Trying to still, you know, kind of have it both ways. You mm-hmm. know, he is trying his darndest to ride this fence. And so he does not reject the emperor, but he doesn't embrace the Bourbons either, and of course that does not work out for him.
Right.
So after the during the Restoration, the Bourbons looked at his service and looked at, you know, what he had done, and he would be named Minister of Justice and things, and then he's sent into exile, like a lot of the, you know, loyal Bonapartists after the final defeat at Waterloo.
Yeah.
And so he goes to Belgium, and he lives across the way in Belgium. He's only there three or so years. And then in the general sort of there was a rapprochement, if we can borrow a French phrase, for the Bourbons made in 1818, where a lot of the old, you know, marshals and Bonapartists and things were welcomed back into France. And then at that point, he does return to France.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though that the Bourbons were, you know, they had the White Terror in 1815 after they come back a second time. And he's also pushed out due to his vote for regicide. Was there records? I think it's fascinating that they were able to track down who voted for the death of King Louis XVI, like decades later, you know, that they were able to like prosecute and find these people who voted for Louis's demise.
Well, yeah, and of course, there still are contemporaries alive who, you know, they vote inside the chamber, so, you know, they all know each other, and
right.
You know, it's not exactly a secret who they did not do a secret ballot for the vote of the king's death, so, you know, everybody kind of knew who voted for what and who didn't.
Right.
But that shouldn't be much of a surprise. Today, I think, regardless of where you live and what political system you are, you can, you know, fairly well figure out which politicians are going to vote which direction on a particular piece of legislation.
True.
Yeah.
Well, our good friend Cambaceres passes in 1824, and he's buried with military honors, which is very nice. What do you think his legacy is looking back on it?
You know, he's remarkable in that he affects the everyday lives of millions of people on this planet, and many of them, of course, have no idea why.
Right.
And that's through the strength of the code.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's the law system throughout most of Europe, a good chunk of Africa. Asia has elements, even in North America, the Quebecois or Louisiana have elements of the code. It's hard to underestimate. So everything in that civil code affects people on their daily lives. So it controlled inheritance, for instance, and how inheritance would work. And there are laws regarding how that can happen. Right. But it's also contract law. So anything, if you rent a property, you know, what rights and responsibilities do you have? What rights and responsibilities does a landlord have? Right. If you buy a house, all of those regulations are governed by the code. If you buy a car, if you have consumer protections for this, you know, your fraud stuff for your credit card, all of these have roots in the code that Cambus Array helped design for eventually what became the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I'm glad you pointed that out. I think just because it's called the Napoleonic Code, I think people just assume that Napoleon went in a room somewhere and had divine inspiration and came up with this code. But it wasn't that way at all. Like you said, it was based on Roman law. Cambus Array and others had their touches to it. So, of course, Napoleon gets the credit because he was the emperor at the time. But there were so many other people working on this.
Well, and right. And I'm not a legal scholar. Mm-hmm. But what I have read, you know, English law is based, common law is based on case precedent.
Yes.
And case law and things. So if you're trying to export that law system to someplace that's never had any of that in the past, it's a difficult law system to get your head around. Mm-hmm. Whereas Napoleon wanted a law system where it was clear from the beginning what's allowable, what's not allowable, without having to have, you know, tons and tons of case law as precedent.
Right.
So I think in that case, too, it was an easier legal system to export, either willingly or unwillingly, onto other cultures and other regions.
Very interesting stuff.
Yeah. You also, though, you don't want to underestimate, you know, people eat. And Cambus Array, through his support of particularly Chef Karam, did a lot for the pastries that we enjoy today. The milfoya, for instance, really takes off during the First Empire, the change of the course and the eating styles. Mm-hmm. You know, this is natural stuff. So if you go to Applebee's and you're going to get an appetizer, a salad, an entree, and maybe a dessert. Well, you know, Cambus Array played a small part in that, but nevertheless, that's about as basic as it comes.
That's a good legacy as well. I love that.
Yeah. Amen.
All right, Charles. Well, thank you as always, my friend. That was really good stuff. One call out. If you want to follow Charles on Twitter, it's the best Twitter handle in the world. Go ahead. Go ahead, Charles.
It's at Bubbles Vampire. It's at Bubbles Vampire.
I love that. And Charles is very active. He's got some great Napoleon posts there on Twitter, and I highly recommend you follow him there. And yeah, my friend, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thanks for inviting me, John. I appreciate it. Had a great time.
Indeed. Me too. Thanks, bud.